Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the first week in April. I'm Mary Robson, and I am absolutely enjoying this spring, even if it brings us sun on one day and rain the next. That's how we know it's April. Today, we'll celebrate the Salish Sea around us with an interview that Nan Evans did last spring. But, of course, first, the mystery sound.
Observations for this week. Reptile. We can wish that lizards had sounds, because one observation is of a full-grown lizard sliding between sunny rocks near Discovery Bay. Its head was hidden, and the observer was not quick enough with reptiles to know which lizard it is. It was definitely on the move, when outside temperatures were about 68 degrees. The rocks were warm to touch. Perfect lizard habitat.
And spring growth. If you watch anywhere in Port Townsend, the trees are greener. Day by day, leafing. Plants are bounding into growth. It seems to me that we often comment on spring coming early, and last week's warmth and calm has brought out some surprising early blooms. Himalayan blackberry flowers already on a south slope. Maybe that means we get early pie. The Scots broom is blooming. The only good part of this is that when it's in bud or bloom, it's easier to see it, to yank the plant out. Looking quite yellow in a lot of places. And I've seen some trillium leaves and buds just starting out in the woodlands. Today we do celebrate the Salish Sea around us. Last April, Nan Evans interviewed Joe Gaidos about his book, The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. We're going to repeat this show, which will give all of us a chance to appreciate the sea around us.
I'm on the phone with Joe Gaidos of the Sea Doc Society today. And if you don't know about the Sea Doc Society, let me introduce you to this great organization. The Sea Doc Society is actually part of the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And located on Orcas Island, the Society works to protect the health of marine wildlife and their ecosystems through science and education. I'm on their monthly e-newsletter, and I love reading it. It's always full of interesting information about projects and findings. And my guest today, he's the director and chief scientist. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Nan. Great to be here.
So Joe is the co-author, along with Audrey Benedict, of a spectacular and inspiring new book. It's entitled The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. The book was just released on March 31st, 2015. And when I first saw a pre-release copy of the book, I was awestruck by the beauty of the photographs and the layout of the book. And when I later read the book, I was struck again by the poetic and inspiring narrative about this place that I love so deeply. So having Joe on Nature Now just seemed absolutely imperative. And my first question for Joe is, so what was your inspiration for the book?
Well, Nan, I'm actually not from here. I was born a little white kid in West Virginia in the mountains.
Oh, and, Joe, I was born a little white kid in Columbus, Ohio. So
excellent. So you know what it's like when I moved out here with my family in 2001, and I really didn't know much about this area or the inland sea, but immediately I fell in love with it, and I was just amazed at everything that was here, and I was amazed at the urban centers that were here as well. And so I just began learning more and more about this area, talking to people, reading things, spending time out on the water, out on the beaches, in the mountains. The impetus for the book was really in the naming of the Salish Sea in 2009. And I thought, man, we really need to have a book about this place, a one-stop shopping guide where people can just sit down and absorb it and be in it. As much awe as I was when I first moved out here, but knowing way more than I knew when I first came.
Well, the book is just magic, and that leads me directly into asking you about the name. Because when I was in oceanography graduate school, I left the Midwest and came to the Northwest in the 1970s. No one talked about the Salish Sea. Instead, we studied Puget Sound or the Straits of Juan de Fuca, Georgia Strait, etc. And then when I returned to this area just a few years ago, people were talking about the Salish Sea. Will you share the story of the name with us?
Right. The story really begins probably back in the 1970s. And it started out of a concern. There was a lot of interest in shipping a lot of crude oil and increased marine vessel traffic in the area. That may sound a little bit familiar to you.
Yeah, really.
And at that time, scientists started studying the area. And they said, this place really functions from Olympia all the way north to Campbell River. It really functions as one unit with a major oceanic influence coming down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And at that time, a scientist at Western Washington University named Bert Weber, he said, we really don't even have a name for this place. And how do we talk about a place and how do we talk about protecting a place when we don't even have a name for it? So in 1989, he went to the Washington Geographic Board of Names and proposed this name, the Salish Sea, in honor of the Coast Salish, who were the first inhabitants in the area. They said, geez, Bert, that's a great idea, but there's really not enough popular usage of that term, Salish Sea. So after a couple of decades, he went back to them in the early 2000s and proposed this name again. And in 2006, the Coast Salish, whose the name is intended to honor, ratified that name at their Coast Salish gathering. Actually, I think it was 2008. And then the following year, Washington Geographic Board of Names, the BC Board of Names, the U.S. Board of Names, and the Canadian Board of Names all adopted this name, the Salish Sea, recognizing it didn't replace Puget Sound or the Strait of Georgia or the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but it was a name for the all-encompassing ecosystem.
And I think it's a great name, and I love the concept of a name for the entire ecosystem because it does function that way. Back to the book for just a second. The subtitle is The Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. Why did you decide to use the term jewel in the title?
Jewel connotes something that you need to take care of, whether it's a family heirloom or a polished stone, something of value. And this is really both. It's something of value, it's something of beauty, and it's something we need to take care of. So it just seemed to fit.
I found a great deal of magic and beauty in the book. Just the critters you were talked about, the bizarre, the beautiful fish. Can you talk a bit about a few of those plants and animals that inspire a sense of wonder in you?
We could start from the invertebrates and move off into the mammals. I always encourage people, find a favorite and talk about it and learn something about it. You know, even from the invertebrates, if you like something that's giant, fall in love with the giant Pacific octopus or the Plumose anemone, the world's largest anemone. Or if you like something that brings money, where the ecosystem brings money back, you know, think about something like the Dungeness crab fishery or the gooey duck fishery, something that is amazing to know that it's out there. Gooey ducks, for instance, can live to be 168 years old, but also amazing because they're a big economic driver for the area. And I would say you could probably work your way through all of the different invertebrates, and there are thousands of different invertebrates that we can see with our eyes, all the way up to the fish. And fish are beautiful in and of themselves, but they also have a purpose. They feed us. They feed other things. They bring joy to people that like to watch them while scuba diving. One of the bizarrest groups of fish that we have in the area are definitely the rockfish.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're in the scorpionfish family, which is kind of a cool thing, not just even for young boys, but they do have a poisonous spines. They have venom that lines the grooves of their dorsal and their anal and their pelvic spines. So they look beautiful. They come in this wide assortment of colors, and then they also have this kind of almost evil aspect of them, this protective value. And then some of them can live to be really, really old. Some of them don't even mature until they're 17 or 18 years old, and other ones like the rough-eye rockfish can live to be over 200 years old. They're an amazing group, and collectively we probably have about 28 different species in the Salish Sea. And then I would say even as far as the birds go, some of my favorite are the diving birds, the owlets. And these are birds that they're not really related, but I call them the northern hemisphere's counterpart to the penguins because they are rarely on land. They're a little bit awkward when they are on land because their feet are pushed so far back on their body. And when they dive under the water, they really fly with their wings underwater and catch fish. Beautiful to watch, and we have a whole bunch of different species. And then what's crazy about that is here you have a bird that spends its whole life almost entirely in the water. Let's say something like a tufted puffin, which was just recently listed as endangered by Washington State. And then when the bird comes to shore, what does it do? It then proceeds to dig a burrow or excavate an old burrow that may be 10 or 15 feet deep. So when it goes on land, it really goes into the land. And these birds will then fly from the burrow out, catch fish, and then fly back. Incredible lifestyles for all of these different fish and birds and invertebrates.
I was reflecting, there was a quote somewhere in the book as well, that tide pools bring out the child in all of us. I love that, because they certainly do for me. And I also was thinking, as you were talking about the birds, there are some wonderful bird photographs in the book. Pigeon guillemots with their bright orange feet just looking silly.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that picture is, you know, one of them is looking over the other guy's shoulder.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, could you move your head a little bit? I'm trying to make a landing here.
Right. And then the picture of the two eagles in their nuptial display. I showed that to a five-year-old the other day, and he couldn't quite get in his head that they were not fighting.
Right, and to see these things lock their feet and go into this spiral down and down and down. Just when you think they're going to hit the water, hit the ground, they'll just pull out of it. It's really amazing.
Yeah. So there are scores of just spectacular photographs and really beautiful writing. I'm interested in any particular observations you might have about the sort of fascinating ways that wildlife adapt to their environment. You talked a little bit about birds flying underwater, and I'm thinking about, the book talks about the dipper and how it sort of feeds in underwater streams. And you talk about how whales and other mammals can dive so deeply. Tell me a bit about some of your favorite adaptations.
I would say my favorite one, being a veterinarian and being a scuba diver, one of my most favorite one is the ability for marine mammals and marine birds to dive. And it's just counterintuitive that here are animals that breathe air, yet most of their daily life function are performed underwater where there's no air. How did they do it? Some of it's pretty simple, right? When you dive underwater, you have to stop breathing, because there's nothing to breathe underneath there. But then, if you think about that, your lungs are taking in oxygen and your heart is beating, well, you don't actually need to send blood to your lungs anymore because they're not doing any work. And so their bodies start shifting blood away from certain areas. You don't want to send blood out to your skin because that's just going to make you cold. And so their heart rate slows down, and they're just sending blood to the heart and to the brain. Oxygenate the heart and send a little bit of blood sugar to the brain. And then at the same time, they never go into that lactic acidosis that we do when we exercise anaerobically. They actually have little molecules of oxygen that are stored at the site of the muscle. There's a molecule really close to hemoglobin called myoglobin. And so those muscles are just down there working away, and they have all the oxygen they could want. And then here's the animal. Not only is it down there holding its breath, but it's actually living most of its life out. It's pretty phenomenal.
That is cool. And a lot of them are feeding down there. It is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
What do you think is the weirdest creature in the Salish Sea?
I would have to say, by far, for me, the giant Pacific octopus.
Oh, yeah.
The more you think about it, the more it's bizarre. I mean, here's an animal, one of the world's largest invertebrates, you know, maybe next to the giant squid. And it can be 150 pounds. And to be so thoughtful about its daily life and intelligent, but really, they're short-lived. They may only live to be 4 or 5 years old.
And they grow so fast.
It's incredible, isn't it? And then when they mate, the female mates once, she may lay 100,000 eggs, and then she'll sit there for 6 or 7 or 8 months and protect those eggs. And then once they hatch out, she dies.
Yeah. So my trivia question for you, of course, is how many suckers are there on an octopus?
That's a great question. And my question to you is male or female?
Right. So I'll say female, and you you can now answer.
Yeah, that makes it easier. So an octopus will have 280 suckers on each of its arms. So that's a total of 2,240 suckers. But on the male, one of his right arms, you know, they have 4 right and 4 left, it's the one he uses to inseminate the female. It only has 100 suckers on it. So it has, the males have 180 left. So I always joke around with people when they, you know, you'll meet someone on an airplane and they'll say, oh, I'm from the Pacific Northwest. I'm from Seattle. I'm from Vancouver. And I'll say, really? And then I'll ask them, how many suckers on a giant Pacific octopus? And when they look at me and they go, male or female? Then I'll say, oh, you really are.
Yeah.
You know that place.
We get that question sometimes down at the Marine Center where we're talking about the giant Pacific octopus, she, the one that's in the tank. And people go, well, how do you know? Well, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's really fun trivia.
What did you learn while writing the book that surprised you the most?
Yeah, so what did I learn that surprised me the most? I would have to say what I learned was how little I knew. And so as we started putting this together, I thought, well, I've been here 15 years, and I've done a lot of work on a lot of different things, and I've been to a lot of lectures, and I've read a lot of books and scientific papers. And then as we started getting into the writing and getting into telling the stories, every day I was uncovering these new things and new things. And it was so exciting for me, one, because we could get them in the book, but two, I was just like a kid in a candy shop. All this great information that I just had no idea of before.
So I know why the book inspires others. It inspires you too.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If a reader were to take away only one message from your book, what do you hope that message would be?
Well, I would say that I hope they come away feeling so amazed at the place where we live, so amazed that they want to take care of this place.
That's a great message. I think the book did it for me.
I love hearing that.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today about this book. I'm almost speechless. It is so beautiful and so inspiring. Thank you. Thank you for doing it, and thank you for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
The mystery sound is a gray whale. Remember the days when whales' songs were part of what we heard for music? We can hear it again. March and April brings gray whales into the Northwest as they migrate from Southern California to Alaska. Several are seen moving through here as transient groups. They top 40 tons each when full grown, and early whalers had named gray whales the devilfish because they fight back when hunted. An interesting detail. Last week, two gray whales near Whidbey Island were seen being attacked by an orca, part of a transient group here. The grays rolled over and over. The orca gave up after considerable mutual fin whacking. Surprisingly, its mother left her two other young ones and intervened, not to fight, but to get him out of trouble. He followed her away from the scene, leaving no visible injuries on the gray whales. According to the Pacific Whale Watch Association, which reported watching and seeing this, quote, perhaps the orca will pick on something his own size next time. Thanks to the Seattle PI for this report, April 3rd, headed Clash of Titans. And finally, events, because spring is here, things are hopping in the event department. First is the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, April 9th, which is a Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. They have a class on spring landscaping for birds. What can you plant that the birds will like? Thursday, April 7th, there is a gathering on the Duckabush River Trail led by Linda Landkammer and Eve Dixon. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Forest Service Ranger Station in Quilcene, which is very easy to find. This is a popular early spring hike to see plants in bloom, and I imagine it's going to be very bloomy. And finally, on Tuesday, April 12th, Andy McKinnon is coming to talk with us about cool plants and their fungal friends. What are your plants doing underground when you don't know? It is at the Port Townsend Community Center, 6:30 to 9 Tuesday, April 12th. And that's it for this spring episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community we all share. Nature Now repeats on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. And if you miss these, check podcasts at kptz.org or just listen to the podcasts for fun.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is From Here You Can Almost See the Sea, performed by David Gray.
Watch the demo nation. Little puppy dog in a box. Somebody's picking the locks. Must wander down from the socks. Here comes cavalry.